Hey, Startup Hustle listeners, before we get into today's episode, I've got some exciting news to share. If you've enjoyed the insights and stories here at Startup Hustle, you're going to love what we have in store at our brand new podcast called Product Driven. I've always described myself as a product guy first, entrepreneur, software engineer, but really a product guy. I love building products. Many people struggle, though, with how to take a product idea and build a tech product, while software engineers struggle to understand the business side of things and they just don't see the big picture. My new podcast, Product Driven, is about that gap between business and the tech side of building software. It's designed for startup founders, tech leaders, software engineers, and anyone who loves tech and startups. Thank you for being part of this community. Enjoy this episode of Startup Hustle, and please subscribe to Product Driven in your podcast app, and you can also check it out on YouTube. Thank you so much.
And we're back for another episode of Startup Hustle, a podcast for entrepreneurs by entrepreneurs. If you want to start, own, or build a business, then you're in the right place. We bring you the real truth about what it's like to take something from concept to launch. From growth, innovation, experience, failing, or winning big, we've got you covered. So let's get down to business with another episode of Startup Hustle, brought to you by Fullscale.io.
What's up, hustlers? Welcome back. This is Andrew Morgans, founder of Marknology, here as today's host of Startup Hustle. We're going to be getting right into it. I'm super excited about today's guest. We're covering a topic that we don't always get into, so I think it's going to bring a lot of value for our listeners. Before we jump in, I make an introduction. Today's episode of Startup Hustle is powered by Fullscale.io. Hiring software developers is difficult. Fullscale can help you build a software team quickly and affordably, and has the platform to help you manage that team. Visit Fullscale.io to learn more. Today's guest company is named Pullman & Comley, and today we're going to be talking about selling online legally. But before we do that, Russell Anderson, welcome to the show. I want to get into your story a little bit. We were jamming before I got started, and I feel like there's a lot to you, and I want to jump into that. And true to the show, we always get into the backstory. So, Russ, I know, be as transparent as you want. Let's have some fun today. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I think we're going to bring a lot of value around e-commerce and how to sell and build a business legally, like what online selling is. But I know you have a big background. Like, did you always see yourself, working in legal or being a partner in a firm like this? Or, did your business or entrepreneur journey start before that?
I actually did kind of view myself as always being an attorney. I actually went back to California to go, clean out my parents' house back in the fall. And I found like some sheet somewhere that literally was me giving sort of what I think my life would be like in 20 years. And I mean, I've pretty much nailed it. I basically was like, I think I'm going to be an attorney from probably when I was like 12 years old or something like that. So I did follow the path that I kind of had set out for myself. But in terms of my, journey within law firms, that's been a little bit more, bumpy. I think, I went to law school, graduated, had a really hard time finding that first gig. And so found myself at this medium-sized firm in Connecticut. And, first day I show up there, one of the partners comes up to me and says, "How would you like to do real estate law?" And so, I was like, okay, that sounds okay. And I did real estate and I did a lot of the types of things I do now in terms of technology contracting and, other things. But, I'm 5.5 years into my career, the partner who is, sort of my mentor is retiring in a year. And I say, okay, well, what's my path look like? I'm going to have to get trained up a little bit more on real estate to, take over this practice in a year. And, the partner says to me, literally, "You're not ready," instantaneously. And then 2 weeks later, someone shows up at my door and says, "Thank you so much for telling us we didn't have a transition plan. We've hired someone to take over that practice," which, is just kind of a little bit of a shock when you're, because the normal pathway for a part, for law firms is, typically you spend like 6 to 10 years kind of building up and then you make partner And so here I am kind of like right on that threshold of where you would start thinking about making partner. And instead of, you know, making partner, they literally just had the door slammed on my face. And so, you know, very quickly after headhunter called and I moved on to, you know, another very small firm where it was just one partner and two associates, where I got to do a lot of really interesting, much more focused work and the kinds of things I really should be doing for my background. Cause I'm kind of, you know, a techie kind of person, especially for East Coast standards. And certainly for the standards of sort of lawyers, you know, of my ilk, my age. And so, you know, I moved on and did a lot more data focused and technology focused work for, you know, 3 or 4 years. And just, I could tell that that firm was also not really going to, you know, support me. And so I moved on to a third firm that was great, a really good fit. But ultimately that firm merged into my current firm, which is Pullman and Comley. And I got sort of taken along for the ride. And the nice thing was they didn't have me, you know, they didn't really have the geek lawyer within Pullman and Comley when I merged in. And it was a really nice, fit. So I've, you know, went right in and kind of did the work that they really needed to have, you know, someone to do in terms of, you know, the kinds of technology contracting and privacy law and the marketing and advertising type work that I tend to focus on. And, you know, in addition to just general corporate. And so as a result, everything worked out and I made partner.
Okay. So is it a firm? Would you guys like, just for those of us that are, you know, less familiar with how some of those, how firms work, I know there's specialties within it. Is your guys' firm, you know, specific around, is it corporate law? Is it like you have different branches of it? Cause you guys are a bigger firm.
My firm is actually a very old firm within Connecticut. It's been around for, you know, 100 years or whatnot. But in terms of the way that, you know, my firm works, and I think a lot of firms work, is, you know, it's a big collection of lawyers. I mean, we have roughly 100 lawyers, and, you know, everyone kind of has the things that they do well, because the law is just too big for, you know, everyone to know everything. And, you know, while I'd like to think that I'm very good at a lot of things, especially with sort of the diverse background that I have, it's just too much for someone to try to do everything. And so, you know, the nice thing with having, you know, a bigger firm, you know, certainly, you know, I think 100 firms is, you know, 100 lawyers is a nice size, is just that you have someone who can help you on just about everything.
Right. Yeah. So when you say, and let's just break this down a little bit, I know you shared a little bit, but like when you say you're the geek lawyer, the tech lawyer, what does that mean in common terms?
Layman's sure. terms. So within my firm, if there's, you know, a software contract, certainly of any size, that tends to find its way to me. Anything involving, you know, website, terms of use, privacy policies, you know, data policies, just sort of generally data security breaches, those types of things find their way to me. IP issues, things like trademark and copyright, online advertising, you know, tends to find its way to me. So all these types of concepts and legal issues, you know, within the construct of my firm, you know, people will generally bring me in and say, "Hey, Russ, you know, can you help, you know, my client with this particular issue?"
Okay, so guys, for anyone listening, that's what geek skills means in the legal world. But it, you know, it's something that definitely, you know, I move around in regards to having an Amazon agency that's, you know, 9 years old, and what we've seen, you know, patents enforcements on the platform, you know, e-commerce enforcements around patents, copyright, trademark, all the different types of trademark from design, knowing the difference between a design mark and a, you know, a traditional, how to go about getting it. You know, Amazon changed a lot of their policies around trademark, because you had, in order to have an established brand on Amazon at one point, you had to have a trademark registration, which could take 9 to 10 months. They sped that up to a 2-week process, in a lot of ways, which was like crazy from when I started it being a 9-month process to like being able to get it in 2 weeks in regards to access on Amazon as if it was like, you know, you still have to wait for it to be official nationally. But in that regard, like, wow, that was a game changer. You know, I've seen, so you have to know about that. Most people say, okay, you're an Amazon expert or you're an Amazon agency, you're managing brands. Well, I know way more about trademarks and patents and enforcement and all of that than I probably should have, you know, working hand in hand with what either legal or just sellers or trying to figure things out. And then being like, wow, this is a whole arena, all the way down to, you know, software. Like, I don't know, there's been a ton of legal issues around the Amazon marketplace in general, in regards to people getting in trouble for doing things unlawfully or bribing officials or bribing workers in different countries that are touching Amazon things, because it's huge commerce. These things that, you know, people will be like, oh, they're gamifying reviews or they're doing things like this, results in millions and billions of dollars in some aspects, depending on who you're talking about. So never took that lightly. I really just thought, like, how to, you know, I definitely moved out of like a, what is this space, to a, I want to be a white hat knight in this space. You know, I was a computer science, I'm a degree in computer science in regards to networking and security. So I was always on the side of studying and learning, like, anti-hacking, you know, how to be more secure, how to have a safe network, you know, how to build security, against attacks like this. I worked in a NOC out of college, which is just a security, network operations control security for MasterCard. Was not my passion, was definitely not my passion, but definitely was my education, in a lot of ways, and learned that quickly. But I took that into, you know, I think that was just my approach when I came into this industry, like, oh, I'm going to do things the right way, because that's kind of like, you know, the way I gravitated. But it's super interesting, and I continue to learn. And I think one thing that we can talk about on the show is, like, maybe even talking about some common mistakes that online sellers fall into, whether it's e-commerce, B2B, Amazon. A lot of them are the same, just like the medium that they're selling is the same. I recently learned about ADA compliance. Like, I don't know what you have to share on that, but that was something that I just wasn't aware of. You know, but that could be a potentially a big risk to, you know, a young brand starting out.
Yeah. And I can certainly speak to that. So what's happened with the Americans with Disabilities Act is it used to be about brick and mortar. And, you know, so basically you have a physical space and there's certain types of entities that are what are called, you know, public accommodations. And those are the ones that are supposed to apply, you know, that this is supposed to apply to. And, you know, what has increasingly happened is that, you know, plaintiffs' lawyers, and again, I say this, you know, as someone who thinks that accessibility on websites is a good thing, but lawsuits against entrepreneurs, you know, are not good things. So, you know, I think there's, you know, so, you know, the good thing with this, I guess, is if I educate you in advance, you can avoid the plaintiff lawyer, you know, the plaintiff's lawyer, you know, coming after you later. But the, you know, what's happened is that, you know, the plaintiff's bar realized that they could essentially force every business in America to have an accessible, you know, website at the, you know, basically by sending demand letters and or suing, to force businesses to meet the accessibility standards. So the accessibility standard that everyone's trying to be forced to meet, according to the plaintiff's bar, is the Website Content Accessibility Guidelines, which are also known by the acronym WCAG. And I believe the current threshold is 2.1 level AA. So that's the standard. And there are tools, actually, that will help you to determine whether or not you meet the standard. So an example of this would be the WAVE tool, which I think Utah State has on their website. I could be wrong about which institution offers it, but, you know, it's really neat. It's a plugin that goes into the browser. You can go and look at your own website, or really any website, and just, you know, see if, you know, see what is wrong with your site before the plaintiff's bar, you know, finds you. Because what's happening is these, you know, the plaintiff's attorneys, you know, troll the internet, you know, run similar tools to go find websites that, you know, aren't doing the right things like, you know, offering alt text on, you know, images, you know, easy low hanging fruit things to prove. And then they file suit, or they send a demand letter basically demanding that you, you know, meet the standard. Oh, and pay them, you know, several thousand dollars in their legal fees for the privilege of telling you that you weren't doing it right in the first place.
Yeah, it's definitely not a good feeling what they're doing in that regard. But that's why I'm bringing it up on the show, is to just make people as aware as they can. You know, better to spend a couple hundred bucks and be in control of that. It's a good thing to do as well. Sure, I do believe that it's a good thing to do. But like you said, not at the expense of, like, you know, ruining someone's business, or, you know, hitting them with a $10,000, $20,000, you know, bill for, you know, not having some kind of compliance on their site. You know, there's, for most websites, there's simple plugins, like you mentioned, that can help you get that done. And that's something that we did last year, just across our sites that we work with. You know, we build our own brands, and just making sure that they were compliant. I think it's the same thing as, you know, if you're in real estate and rentals or in any other business, like, you're exposed. And in the web, there's just not, it's still so Wild West that, you know, there's not a lot of thought leadership. Like, even this podcast, this episode, what we're talking about is online, like, selling online legally and what that looks like. There's not a lot of content out there that's saying, hey, these are some of the pitfalls you can fall into, because it hasn't happened to that many people yet. You know, having insurance on your products is another one. Let's talk about that. Just like, at what level of a small business, a little maker selling with an Etsy shop or a website or on Amazon, you know, what do you really need to be doing or thinking about, to protect yourself with your products? You know, we've all heard about someone getting sued, like McDonald's getting sued for hot coffee. You know, it's hot coffee, you know, was the label not big enough? Like, what was that about? And you can think about your products and be like, well, how's anyone going to hurt themselves with a phone case or this or that? But there are certain things you need to think about, if you're really trying to build a brand online and sell, to protect yourself. Do you know, like, some of the thresholds for, like, when you need insurance on, you know, your business as an online business, like, what threshold that looks like?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I don't know if there's, like, a specific number at which you cross the threshold of, I should go get insurance. But
okay.
I think there's a way of thinking about this. So when you start a business, presumably you should form some form of, you know, limited liability company, whether that is an LLC or, you know, a more formal corporation. And, you know, basically what you do is you put your business in the LLC or the corporation, and you're basically saying, these are the assets that are tied to this business. And if there's a claim, these are the assets you can go after. Right. And so by doing that, you kind of build a certain amount of insurance in the first place. And then obviously you hope that your business will grow and expand. And, you know, when it's big enough that it justifies spending the money on the insurance premiums, because you wouldn't want to lose all the things that you've now put in this box that is, you know, your company, you know, that's really where that threshold, you know, kicks over. And so I'm not exactly sure what the premiums are on, you know, products liability insurance, but let's say they're like 10 grand, you know, or something like that for a small business that, you know, sells enough units to make a difference. You know, if your business is worth, you know, $300,000 a year, absolutely, you should be spending the 10 grand on the products liability insurance to, you know, make sure that you, you know, can control that risk. If on the other hand, it's 10 grand versus 10 grand, then you're probably not at that equation yet.
Right. That's good advice. I do believe it to be quite a bit less than that, at least for that size of business, like, you know, sub 1 million. Yeah. But, you know, you start adding up these costs when you're just, like, maybe for the first part, you're like, this is a side hustle turning into a business in a lot of ways. That's how a lot of people's business starts. And this is something that they're doing for extra money or passion, and they're not thinking through all of these things, because you start adding those things up and it's a lot of reasons to say no. You know, it's a lot of reasons to be like, this isn't even worth it. I'm paying $5,000 in insurance. I'm paying, you know, $500 a month to have ADA compliant websites, or I'm paying, like, you know, yada, yada, yada. The list goes on and on and on. It can be a lot of reasons why not to do something. And that's not what I'm trying to share, but more so, like, once you get to the point where your business is bringing in revenue that's substantial to you, these are things that you need to start thinking about, and how to protect yourself and insulate and solidify your business from those trolls, from, you know,
yeah,
people that are just looking for an opportunity. I got a couple questions for you, but before I do, shout out to our sponsor, Fullscale.io. Finding expert software developers doesn't have to be difficult, especially when you visit fullscale.io, where you can build a software team quickly and affordably. Use Fullscale platform to define your technical needs and then see what available developers, testers, and leaders are ready to join. Visit fullscale.io to learn more. So a couple of points I wanted to bring up and make sure our listeners walk away with. Why do e-commerce companies need legal advice or a lawyer on retainer or need that as part of their team? Let's start there before I hit you with the next one. I don't want to complicate it. But I think that's one that's just like, why do I need a lawyer as an e-com business?
Right. And I think the main thing is just a lawyer can keep you out of trouble in the first place. I mean, I've had a couple of different clients, for lack of a better way of putting it, you know, they just didn't talk to me. Like, you know, I was their counsel. I was doing work for them, but they just weren't, you know, I think in part maybe to minimize the bill or whatnot, you know, they just weren't having me work on, you know, sort of the day-to-day things that they were doing. And, you know, in each case, they didn't really have a good set of commercial terms with their customers. And so this was a B2B scenario. And, you know, in each case, there were problems with the product or the relationship. And, you know, they ended up getting sued. And so I've had two different clients get sued in the last year where, I mean, frankly, I could have prevented, you know, I might have been able to prevent the suit altogether, or at the very least put them in a much better position, you know, within the lawsuit for, you know, for just not having damages really against them. And so, you know, it's a struggle because, you know, ultimately I care about my clients and seeing them, you know, have to spend, you know, a lot of money, you know, on legal fees sounds like a great thing for me, but it's not really my preferred position. Like I'm a corporate person. I want my clients to succeed and do well without having the stress of litigation and bad things happening to them. And so
you want them to stay in business so that you
want them to stay in business. And so, you know, I think, I think that kind of regular touch with your attorney and sort of hearing what they have to say and talking about your business and what you care about. And maybe, you know, something like the ADA issue that we just talked about, you know, maybe I could have flagged that and said, hey, I've seen a lot of, you know, clients getting hit with this. Something for you to think about. And just sort of like, you know, getting people ahead. And that's the kind of the relationship with a lawyer that you can, you know, hopefully establish.
Yeah, and it's so much better to be in a position where you're paying for that legal advice when you're not in trouble. You're not already in legal trouble. Now you're paying to defend and, like, you know, just get yourself out of it. But, you know, I'm going to spend a couple grand here and get more insulated and prepared or get some better advice, or I'm going to get my contracts better. This is just like something I thought of while you were sharing. How important do you think it is? And this is coming from my own perspective, but I want to hear from you. How important do you think it is for a young business owner, or as in the business being young, or a newer business owner, to like be organized when it comes down to defending them, when it comes down to like really getting yourself out of trouble, you know, like defending your case, or like, you know, being able to present, at least in my experience, it was like, you know, if I had been documenting better, if I had been like, you know, paying more attention to contracts or different things like that, most of the time, whatever I'm into, I can get out of, or I'm like, I'm in the clear, or I'm like, you know, I'm protected. It's been the times that I wasn't taking good notes or documenting well, or like really being organized and couldn't find stuff that I needed, that I felt the most exposed. As of just a general rule of thumb, when it comes down to those things and you're like trying to help somebody that's in trouble, like, you know, how important is that?
I think being organized is a very, well, I mean, just in general as a life skill, it's obviously very helpful. I think in legal world in particular, I mean, yes, it's very helpful for really all different types of things. I mean, everything from, you know, just making sure that you're on top of, you know, the customer contracts or the supplier contracts, or, you know, whatever it might be. The interesting thing is, it's not even just, you know, as you're going day to day that the organization matters. It matters on the back end. So when you actually go to sell your company or raise money, the fact that you have your stuff together really matters. because when an investor comes to go look at your business, and they will do legal due diligence, and you've got everything squared away, it is very impressive. And it makes you look professional. It makes you look good. It makes you look like you're someone who's worthy of, you know, having this investment, or frankly, you know, that they can trust that they can buy your business entirely. So it's a weird kind of thing to think about, but you know, when you're starting your business, if you're organized and doing the right things, it flows all the way through to when, you know, you're actually trying to sell either parts of or all of your business.
I think there's like really two types of, like, you know, entrepreneurs or business owners or whatever you want to call it. And I'm generalizing, but in general, there's like, you know, I'm more of the creative side. Like, I was a musician before I got into this, and I'm a little bit of a hybrid because I was a techie, but that would like to be creative, you know? And it was like, that's really what I love e-commerce is, because I feel like you get to be creative and invent and be innovative, but then also you have to have a technical background to operate it and implement it. But before I found e-commerce, it was music. It was all these things. And, I'm definitely someone that I like was very forward and early in the Amazon industry and space, like a creative, almost like a creative move. You know, caring about something before other people do, but I've had to learn the skill over the last 8 years, 9 years of getting organized and systems and process. And there's the other type of people that are, they start with that foot forward. They might be a little bit less creative and innovative, but like everything's got its proper place and documentation and systems and scale, and those things come natural to them. So wherever you are on that kind of tipping point, from my end, I've always just wished now that I've like learned some of these things, like, man, I wish I had documented all of this. I wish I had been so much more organized. What does it look like when you talk about on the back end and being organized for a company that's trying to buy you? Because that is definitely something I'm actually in courses, not that I'm looking to exit, but I'm in courses, getting coached, on all the things to think about for an exit and what that looks like, just so that I can prepare as best as possible. Is that like having all of your contracts in nice little folders? Is that like, you know, knowing, you know, that your system, your business can run without you? Is that like having clients that might be here in long-term contracts? Like what does that actually mean to be organized on the back end?
Right. So an easy way to sort of do this is, I bet you if you Google, and I haven't done this myself, but if you Google due diligence checklist, you know, or legal due diligence checklist, I bet you can find something that sort of breaks down the kinds of things that, you know, lawyers are going to be asking of you, you know, when you go to exit or when you go to, at the very least, do a financing round. And so you have to sort of break your company into bits. So you think about your company as a corporate entity, you know, so if you're an LLC, do you have an operating agreement? Does it document well what your ownership structure is? And how you're run? Do you have minutes to show that, you know, if you have a board that, you know, show the decision-making process that has gone on the major decisions? So if you did bank financing, that you have minutes of showing that you approved, you know, the bank financing. So that's like one aspect of it. And then you might have employee aspect of it. Do you have a employee handbook? You know, do you have, you know, good employee contracts with, you know, your executives to, you know, reflect, you know, what those relationships are like? Do you have, you know, good customer and supplier relationships and contracts there? And, you know, and you can break your business up into all these little component parts. And if you look at a due diligence checklist, you'd kind of get a sense of what that might look like. And obviously the more that you have in place, the better you look. I mean, if you haven't done it, I've seen businesses sold literally in the last year that I've worked on, where they did nothing. I mean, it was the business was, I was jokingly calling this business non-legal. Like they had done everything on handshakes and, you know, with no attention to legal for 20 years, built a good business and were able to sell. And it worked out and it was, you know, fine. Yep. For them. You know, I was on the buy side and our buyer, you know, in that instance, you know, was reasonably okay with that. And, but, you know, it still creates friction when, you know, if you're the buyer side, you're trying to get a business that's clean. And so the more that you, you know, have, you know, these points where it's just not that clear that everything's been done correctly, there's that extra nervousness, that comes in. And sometimes that can infect the deal terms. So for example, you know, a lot of M&A transactions will have, you know, escrows and whatnot of money being set aside to cover potential claims. And, you know, if the business is not particularly clean and the buyer's nervous, the escrow demand might be higher because they're just less confident that everything's been, you know, managed correctly.
It's like buying a property and doing inspections and being like, you know, we just don't really know what this, you know, floor is like once we're going to rip this carpet up. You know, we just don't know, or foundation being, you know, and they're going to come back and make a lower offer because, you know, they don't know all these things. Or maybe, you know, in that circumstance, just to relate it, like, you know, someone's looking at the foundation of your business and having questions, you know, it's going to be a question mark on that process instead of it being like proactively. So we've like, you know, we've talked about proactively, like what you can do, which is like being organized and being ADA compliant and, you know, getting your trademarks, or like, those are all pretty much proactive things you can do, you know, to not get in trouble. Let's end the last part of the show, hearing from you a little bit about like what kind of issues e-commerce companies run into with trolls, or like just with, I guess, people looking for opportunities to, like, you know, have a lawsuit or get a brand in trouble. What are some of the issues that you've seen working with e-commerce companies?
Yeah, so some of these are actually kind of easy to really flag out. So an easy one is copyright issues. So, you know, generally with images, it's the person who created it. So if it's a photographer, it's the person who took the picture, you know, owns that particular, you know, photo. And increasingly what I've seen is that, you know, sometimes people will just, you know, use things they find on the internet and say, I can use this, right? And the answer is no. And what's happening more and more is that, especially for things that might be, you know, stock photography or from the big agencies, you know, they have someone trolling the internet with bots looking for, you know, where, you know, images get used. They find that you've used an image, and, you know, they'll have a lawyer send, you know, a demand letter for, you know, roughly maybe $5,000, $1,000, whatever it might be, saying you used our image without our permission, without paying, you know, pay us. And it's just such an unforced error, because it's so easy just to, you know, if, especially for stock photography, you know, just pay the money, or, you know, or just at the very least understand, you know, where the images you're using come from, and, you know, make sure that you have the license. You know, and if it's a friend who took the photos, or, you know, someone, you know, that you've paid, or maybe you haven't paid them, and that's the problem, you know, it's just, you have to make sure that before you start building your website based off upon these photos, that you make sure you have the rights. Because if you don't, and let's say hypothetically you have a dispute with your photographer and you've had them take, you know, 1,000 photos for you of your entire product line, but then they try to charge you triple, you know, you might be in a position where they'll try to take your whole website down using a DMCA complaint. And trust me, no, I mean, the website will do it, because the alternative is really just to have a copyright claim against the website itself. And so it's that to me is an unforced error, is, you know, so just making sure you have the copyright rights, you know, set. I think another example is obviously, and you know, you were mentioning this, Andrew, is trademarks. I mean, making sure that, you know, when you go to brand, that you really, you know, make sure that you have, you know, some proper clearance, you know, in the, you know, proper clearance done, you know, make sure that you, you know, you understand sort of where you live within an ecosystem with your brand. It's very rare that you're ever going to have like a perfectly clear, completely imaginative brand that no one has anywhere near you. But at the very least, you can, you know, understand sort of what your risks are before you go to market with a particular, you know, branding. And especially, you know, if you're taking something like, you know, like, I'll just give an easy example, but if you're going to, you know, be using something with three stripes, you know, Adidas is going after literally everybody with that. Like, so if you're adjacent to somebody that's really aggressive, like clothing companies, I think are infamous for this, especially, you just know that you shouldn't be going into that ecosystem and picking that fight. You know, and I think, and this is, I think, what you were, you know, thinking about a little bit, Andrew, is also just, it's not just how you stay out of trouble, you know, from, you know, plaintiffs, lawyers, and others, but I think it's also how do you defend your brand? And so, you know, a lot of law and a lot of what I'm sort of talking about is sort of, you know, thinking about law as being, you know, a shield, right? And so, you know, saying if I do all these right things, like I'm going to be protected against this kind of claim or this, but, you know, I think sometimes you have to think about sort of, you know, when you can do things to help protect yourself a little more aggressively upfront. And so, you know, an example of this is I've seen, you know, a few different, you know, clients of mine, you know, have people kind of impersonate them. And so, you know, if you create, you know, a brand like, you know, Startup Hustle, you probably want to own 50 domains around it, right? So Startup Hustles, StartupHustle.org, StartupHustle.net, because if you don't, then, you know, someone can impersonate you like that. And then all of a sudden, like, you know, they start sending out emails impersonating you, you know, maybe doing scams.
It's happening to me right now on social media. Like, you know, there's probably 3 accounts or so on Instagram that look, it's crazy because they actually have like my videos, my posts, like everything, right? It's like a nuance of a letter or an underscore or something you can't even really tell, even if you've been following me a long time. And they're sending out DMs, you know, they're like acting as me at this time, and going straight to Instagram does nothing for me.
Exactly. It's so, I mean, it can be really hard to affirmatively stop these folks because, again, even if you own 50 combinations, you know, there's always probably going to be the one that you miss. But at the same time, you can really narrow the field and make it that much harder for them. And, you know, I've had clients, you know, within the last year, really this one really rapidly expanding, you know, e-commerce and also just retail, physical retail company, you know, really run into trouble against someone who was out for them. You know, basically copied their website, you know, changed one letter in the domain, somehow, I don't know how, but effectively got them locked out of their own Facebook account, was running ads, basically pretending to be them, you know, and point by point, we went through and, you know, managed to get most of these things down over time. Certainly having a registered trademark in this helps, because it just makes that process that much faster to get these things down. But you know, you really, it's hard, you know, and it's reactive. And so the more that you can do up front to sort of limit the issues as much as you can, the better, because that's really all you can do to protect yourself.
I kind of think of it like creating a moat. Like, it's an old school, you know, thing, but like, you know, it's the water around a castle where, you know, whoever's attacking the castle can't even get close without going through this tar, this, you know, this water slows them down, you know, so they, you know, castles have still been sieged, or there's other ways of doing it, but it really slows things down. And I think that's kind of what I think of as like, you know, insulating yourself with trademarks or copyright, $60. Like, you can get a copyright on your images that you're using for like $60 if you submit it yourself or something like that, you know, which is, it's not a trademark, it's not a patent, but it's a lot more than having nothing at all. And on channels like Amazon, it's enough to be able to police your brand. And, you know, most people just think like, you know, they're not thinking about, well, I don't want to spend 60 for that. Well, what are you losing in branding, or what are you losing in reputation, or what are you losing in potential sales from not doing those things? So, you know, a lot of times when it comes to advertising on Amazon, we're advertising all around the brand to protect them and insulate them. And, you know, you really don't give these things as much, I guess, attention or value that you really should until something bad happens. And that's what's like, you know, so bad about those kinds of things, is that it really takes almost like getting whacked upside the head, so to speak, for you to be able to pay attention to this stuff. And as an agency owner and you on the other side, I think we can both, you know, we're just harping on You know, pay attention to these things. You're not a victim till it happens, you know, kind of thing. But like, once you get in deep with a competitor that's really out for you, it can be really bad. And, you know, what are the things you've done to protect yourself? This is a great, a lot of value, Russ. You know, thank you for sharing all this. We're coming up on time, so I have a hard stop for us. But before we jump off, where can people come in contact with you, you know, your personal brand, you know, if they're looking for help, legal help, like what's the best way to contact you directly, you know, outside the firm?
Sure. So best way to contact me is just, you know, Russell Anderson, and that randerson@polcom.com, which is my email address.
Okay. Can you just spell that?
Sure. R Anderson with an O at the end, and that's at Polcom, okay. PULLCOM.com.
Perfect. And we'll have all of this in the show notes for anyone that's like, you know, on a computer listening to the podcast. But for anyone driving, I hope that's been helpful. You know, we're sharing this kind of information for free. You know, this is not stuff that you get all the time. And, you know, I don't love talking about all the bad things that can happen, but I think it's important to really think about. And it's more so like, you know, being in the gym, being healthy, being fit, stretching, so that whenever like something comes along, you feel like, you know, you're prepared to handle whatever comes. So Russ, thank you so much for your time. It's been awesome having you on the show.
Thank you, Andrew. Appreciate it.
And hustlers, shout out again to our sponsor, FullScale. Do you need to hire software engineers, testers, or leaders? Let FullScale help. They have the people and the platform to help you build and manage a team of experts. When you visit fullscale.io, all you need to do is answer a few questions, let the platform match you up with fully vetted, highly experienced team of software engineers, testers, and leaders. At FullScale, they specialize in building long-term teams that work only for you. Learn more when you visit fullscale.io. Always a mouthful, always a lot of fun hanging out with you guys. Hustlers, thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
Startup Hustle's brought to you by FullScale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. Make sure you reach down and hit that subscribe button, then come find us on Instagram. See you next time. We do it.